The 2020 presidential election is around the corner. Let's all mobilize. Let's all be on the right side of history. Make the moral choice between love versus hate. Let's do the right thing. You know I had to get that in there.
That was the one and only Spike Lee last night at the Academy Awards, where the former Mars Blackman won his very first Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay on Black Klansman, while also demonstrating why those of us of a certain age should not attempt in high-pressure situations to read our own handwriting, a fact already tweeted out naturally by the President of the United States. Donald Trump also called Lee's speech racist because, of course, he did. Welcome to 2019, everyone. Welcome also to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined per usual by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and a returning triumphant Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy Green Book, everyone.
Hi, Matt.
Da-da-da. Hi.
The greatest movie of our time.
I wanted to, speaking of which, give a shout out to Catherine's replacement, Stephanie Slade, who at the end of last week's podcast, we all remember, made the prescient observation that Green Book sort of kind of feels a little bit out of step with the prevailing cultural demands for how to present racially themed stories in dramatic fashion, which I think has kind of been borne out by the incredibly hostile reaction to it winning. Catherine, you were allegedly on vacation last week, and I've even seen a picture that would suggest that might be true. And yet, on Sunday, you showed up in my paper here, the New York Times, like a Bauhaus, writing an Oscar-pegged piece called Stop Counting Women, which is really weird. Quotas and tallies won't bring real progress on gender parity. What are you talking about? How does that to play into what you obviously watched the entire broadcast last night? It just sort of feels like the last several Oscars have all been about representation and displaying of people and counting up and tallying. Why is that a bad approach to things, Catherine?
Because people aren't widgets, man. So I wrote this this op-ed for the New York Times before I went on vacation, and they held on to it to run it alongside the Oscars because it's about this weird obsession that we have with getting to 50-50. And I think that that's, you know, if you ask most people sort of casually, hey, what's a fair allocation of women in category X? They will say 50-50 because women are half the population. But the pursuit of 50-50 in lots of categories actually seems to cause a bunch of distortions, a bunch of weirdness. They actually trimmed out of this op-ed my gentle proposal for the Oscars specifically to solve this problem, which was, hey, we already have different categories for men and women in acting. Why don't we just put different categories for men and women in everything if you're so keen to give these awards to ladies? Which involved the word best directrix. And anyway, they didn't like that part, which is fair enough. In particular, I said, and I still believe, that the Roma Prize for Best Director, which was a sign that there is some justice in the world, is a great case study in, like, this is a movie about women. It's a movie about, you know, childbirth and being abandoned by a shitty man and a bunch of other very
the shitty
whole thing.
Men.
Men.
Multiple. It is a movie filled with shitty men.
Shitty men. And women who sort of move in a world of their own. And it's beautiful and, at least to my mind, accurate. And the prize for best director for this movie went to a man and therefore shows up in the wrong column when you're counting. And I think that kind of thing.
How does social change happen, though, if people don't actively militate for change? And it doesn't. Let me just throw out, you know, this shouldn't be a conversation between we have to have quotas and we have to have absolute parity in every across every ethnic, every demographic, every gender dimension. But I mean, you know, Penny Marshall was one of the people who died this past year and was in memoriam. She didn't get her due as a female director. Female directors are like in the single digits in the Directors Guild. And it doesn't mean like, okay, tomorrow we have to have 50% of all nominees for Best Director be women or something like that. But I mean, and again, to get out of the box of like, how does change happen? Then if people don't say, you know what, enough is enough. And like women in movies, you know, they're a big part of the industry. Why shouldn't there be more female directors? What are the forces that keep that from happening? And then how do you overcome that? I find a lot of the conversations about, weird, disproportionately out of bounds representation in fields to be kind of numb to the idea that change doesn't just happen. People have to talk about it and then take specific actions to overcome it.
I just want to throw out there, since Matt mentioned that this has been a theme for several years, if you remember Frances McDormand's speech last year when she won an acting award, was that she sort of threw out at the end of her speech, I got two words for you, inclusion writers. And nobody knew what those were, though it seems fairly clear once you kind of think about it. It's a part of a contract that you can at least theoretically get put into your contract when you sign onto a movie if you are a star or player of enough power, that basically says that a certain percentage of people have to be women, minorities, et cetera. And that this is a form of private power. This is somebody, I mean, like if you take somebody who is an Oscar winner like Frances McDormand, who has been kind of a top-ranked actress now for at least 20 years, sort of going back to Fargo, if not further, and is someone who is saying, look, use your power to make change happen privately. You have to, this is a way of forcing people to
do
it.
Well, it's not, because you don't have to contract.
And it's also a kind of counting, right?
I mean, it's volitional.
That's true, yeah. But okay, of pressuring, I should say, not forcing, but of pressuring people. And that pressure, to me, these sorts of private pressure tactics, I know a lot of libertarians kind of recoil at them. I get that, and I understand that instinct, but at the same time, I think that the relationship that libertarians should have to those sorts of private pressure tactics, at the very least, should be much more complicated and nuanced than, say, to mandatory percentages of a certain gender on, say, corporate mm-hmm. boards, which is something that Catherine brought up in her op-ed.
Well, here's a way of looking at it, and Catherine, maybe you can start with this since you're the
editor. Hey, can we all take turns cutting off the woman while we're on this topic?
Which, by the way, happened to Frances McDormand last night, although that was kind of a gag. But from what I recall back when I looked at such statistics, there's kind of an iron 90% rule of audience for opinion journalism. This is both op-ed page, editorial pages of newspapers, opinion magazines. It's probably a little bit softened since then, but that the appetite, the market out there, at least as, you know, as has been demonstrated by the ruts that got us here, with the exception of Mother Jones, just because the word mother's in the title, people are going to have overwhelmingly male audiences for opinion journalism. How do you kind of how do you approach your work, or how does that number wash over you? And what is the kind of private action that you take based on? Is that a market opportunity in your mind?
So this is, I actually called up VIDA, which is this group where what they literally do is count bylines, right? They do, it's women in literary arts, so they do book reviews and cultural commentary, but they look at, I think, 40 publications, and they just count the bylines. They count the names and see, they run a little report that's, you know, are you achieving parity? And I called specifically to ask that question, okay, fine, you know, these numbers are maybe not where they should be in the absence of, even leaving aside personal choice and a bunch of other things, there are probably some institutional factors that keep women out of these pages. At the same time, if your readership is historically 80 to 90% male, as mine is, are you really going to look me in the face and tell me I have to run 50-50 or else I've failed in your eyes? And the person I talked to, Sarah Clark, who's a board member there, said essentially, you know, gender parity is something you should always strive for. 50% is something you should always strive for. But then they, Sarah is non-binary, so they, them pronouns, friends. But then said the thing that comes up a lot, which was the business case is then what happens here. Like in this conversation, what always happens is that then people say, plus it's good for your business to build female audiences. And it's a tricky little two-step there, right? Because it's obviously true that if we could grow our female audience, that would be better. Of course that's true. And, you know, Sarah said, investing in building trust with readers who are women and who are non-binary is an investment worth making. True. Absolutely true. At the same time, though, that exact argument also came up in California when they mandated female board membership. And they said, we're going to require this because it's going to benefit the economy. And it's that two-step that I find really troubling. Like, if it is, in fact, definitely true for business, good that it would be good for business to move toward more female readership representation, whatever, then it would not be necessary to pass a law. It would not be. And of course, there are lagging factors. Of course, there's drags. But in fact, like everyone is moving in these this direction already to the extent that they're capable. And to say you're a failure unless you're 50-50, you're a failure unless you're an illegal failure unless you have a woman on your board. I think, you know, the metaphor that I use in the piece is it's the same as people who go on a diet, right? Like you count calories, you do your macros, you do whatever it is that people do with their diets. To learn how to think better about your choices. But the person who's standing next to you at lunch going, that doesn't seem very healthy, like that doesn't win over anyone. So I guess I think I'm making a case for effective suasion as well as a case for accepting less than 50-50 in a bunch of circumstances where 50-50 isn't warranted.
Peter, the only category in which I saw a majority of the films was obviously the animated category last night. And even then, I didn't see the winner, which is Into the Spider-Verse, which everyone says is great. And I'm sure that you, you've flogged on this podcast because I remember everything. But from what I understand in the acceptance speeches and in the post coverage, that representation was actually kind of part of the galvanizing art of that piece there. Can you talk to that a little bit? And if that was part of the overall experience, is like, hey, look, this is different than your usual nerdy white Peter Parker guy.
In fact, I have a piece about this in the current issue of Reason Magazine, which you should all buy and subscribe
to. Especially if you're a woman.
Catherine Mengu Ward, our woman editor-in-chief, asked me to write, after I had already written a kind of a sketch that kind of touched on this on the website. And I was like, really? You want me to write more about Spider-Man? Okay, I can do that.
Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, man.
I was not. I was just, I was very, very pleasantly surprised. Anyway, so this piece basically says that if you look at Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, it's the first superhero film to really embrace the malleability of superhero identity. And superheroes have always kind of been stand-ins for their readers. And so if you go back to the 1960s when Spider-Man was sort of first imagined, Spider-Man was like a nerdy white guy from New York, from Queens, who had like all of these kind of like awkward social problems, right? He had trouble with girls. He had trouble keeping a job. There were conflicts with Aunt May, who was his kind of a guardian parental figure. And so he has all of these, you know, sort of very ordinary kind of schlubby, nerdy white dude problems. And then, of course, he has his alter ego, which is this kind of, which is the power fantasy in which he can kind of work out those issues. And in a way, he was there to serve as a kind of a model and a stand-in for a lot of his readers who happen to be, for the most part, nerdy, white-ish guys. What Spider-Verse is based around, though, is a different Spider-Man, Miles Morales, who is black and Puerto Rican, also from New York, but exists in a kind of parallel dimension in which the Peter Parker Spider-Man dies and Morales takes over. Also gets basically the same set of powers, takes over. And then there's a bunch of other Spider-Men who show up and Spider-Women. There's a Spider-Woman. There's also a Spider-Pig. There's Spider-Man Noir, who is voiced delightfully by Nicolas Cage in actually Nicolas Cage's only his second best role last year. Mandy would have been the first. And so the whole movie is about the idea that, in fact, Spider-Man was never a particular character, or never just a particular character with a very specific fictional backstory in which he's only this one person who exists in this only in this one way. In fact, what he is he's a model for living. He's an idea. And it's not even necessarily that he is an idea. It's that he or she or pig is an idea. and that what this movie does and what it really embraces in a way that we haven't seen so much with the big budget live action films, which have hewed to relatively conventional presentations of these of their superheroes. What this movie really embraces is the idea that we are all kind of Spider-Man, and that Spider-Man is for all of us, and that Spider-Man can take any form, perhaps even including in your own life.
By the way, the success of that, and I agree with you, Peter, is, you know, and people who read comics a lot, that also helps explain why Spider-Man, regardless of who was drawing and writing the comic books, was always pretty good. The idea behind it somehow is more appealing than many other superheroes. The comic books go up or down based on the quality of the team that's actually producing it at any given moment. But Spider-Man, Peter, I would be interested if you agree with this. It's like somehow Spider-Man was always pretty good. It didn't matter if he had like the shittiest creative team behind him or the best. It was always like there was always something appealing about it. And I think it speaks to what you're talking about, that there's that idea behind there that has a kind of universal appeal.
There's people who would argue that some of the
do
soapier
like,
aspects.
Or do we hate the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man?
I think all the Spider-Man movies are at least pretty good, right? The third Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie is probably the worst. The Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movies are kind of not super well liked. But if you watch them, they're like pretty tolerable. And the real problem with them is that they just repeat a lot of the beats that we've already seen. They're not bad. They're just not original in any way. I think in terms of the comic books, there are fans who would say things that, like, for example, some of the clone sagas, and there are several of them. And this comes up actually a little bit in the piece, right? Is that Spider-Man? It sometimes is like he's a clone. Sometimes he's not like a nerdy white guy in a red and blue suit that he made himself. Sometimes he's also connected to a black suit that is also a living symbiote that becomes, right. He changes identity in the comic books all the time, And because Spider-Man is not, again, because Spider-Man is much more of an idea than he is simply a very specific character with a very specific history. And that is a big part of his appeal and what allows, Into the Spider-Verse, which draws on a tradition from the comics, from the Ultimate Spider-Man comics, in which Miles Morales was first created, really kind of leans into that in a way that we've never quite seen on the big screen before, where superheroes have basically been relegated to a single persona.
I would add before we leave the topic, although we will get later on at the end of the show to libertarian movies here, which I'm naming here not only to tease for the listeners, but to remind the participants.
Thank you. Thank you. We're doing this.
No faith.
Sometimes the acts of like super self-conscious representation in places that have been historically, you know, white or whatever you want to call it, produce kind of galvanizing culture or just changed results. On a personal level, I experienced this going on MSNBC's Melissa Harris-Perry program, which I really enjoyed. Oftentimes, I was the only male, only white
person. Certainly the only libertarian.
there was other libertarians on occasion. I met a lot of people there who I'd never seen, I'd never encountered anywhere there, but who then became, Jelani Cobb is someone who comes to mind easily, became people I've just have been fascinated and wondered, my God, how come, these people weren't more broadly known? And MSNBC has been able, unlike most cable companies, to produce audiences from segments of the population that weren't previously engaging in that kind of media consumption, which is interesting. And the way this all wraps around to last night is that I grew up a huge Spike Lee fan as a teenager, so I was really happy to see him on stage, even though didn't see the movie, and who knows if it's any good. It felt like more of a Lifetime Achievement Award. But it was Samuel L. Jackson who introduced him. Samuel L. Jackson, everybody loves Samuel L. Jackson. Spike Lee discovered him. You know,
Spike Lee, Samuel L. Jackson, not just everybody loves him. He is now the most box office winningest star in movie history. The Hollywood Reporter, I believe, did actually a great feature cover story on how nobody has been in more in like if you add up the box office tallies of all actors ever, Sam Jackson is the one who has made the most money.
He's also
been in the most movies.
Yeah, he's the Michael Caine. Like, there's not a thing that he's going to turn down. But there was
can we?
Yeah,
sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, can we take a brief detour? Also, I have no idea if it was even nominated for any Oscars, but I watched Crazy Rich Asians on the plane, which was also like just straight up representation. It was like, let's get a whole bunch of actors who people in America broadly did not know, who now are household faces, household names. They showed up. I'm looking at like the Oscars dresses, which is the only thing that I look at for the Oscars. And like the whole cast of Crazy Rich Asians is right there
at
the top.
It's almost like there's a gender difference on this podcast.
It's weird. But I want to say, having watched this movie late, like I watch all movies, I have no one to talk with about the fact that that movie is actually about game theory, you guys. Why is no one talking about it? It's literally about game theory. She's a professor of game theory. She wins Prince Charming in the end by correctly applying the insights of game theory against the matriarch of the Singapore Chinese clan.
I haven't seen the movie.
It sounds like Peter needs to assign Catherine
right?
this article.
I want to hear. Yeah, now I actually want to. You're the first person to really make a pitch.
Theory, guys.
Oh, no!
This is definitely the best pitch I've heard for this movie. But I would just note back to the point that we started with, which was your op-ed and mandatory diversity and all of these things, and whether it's better for business, is that the producers on that film made a business bet that it would be a popular success because they were offered in a you have like a 1 hour to decide just a gigantic pile of money guaranteed from Netflix. But what happens when you do that is you don't get audience data. You don't sort of, I mean, yes, Netflix has been putting more films in sort of the award circuit, but you don't get the audience data, right? There's just sort of, it's a flat amount of money. It's often a very large amount of money for some of these sorts of things. And what they said was, no, we want to bet that this will actually bring audiences to theaters, that it will be a global success, that it will prove to Hollywood. And part of it was ideological as well. They wanted to prove to Hollywood that you could make a lot of money with a movie that had essentially an all-Asian cast. And they did. And so it was a bet that both their sort of their priors ideologically about representation, as well as their kind of skills as filmmakers, that there was an audience there and that they could make money.
Just pursue this a bit? Because, you know, this, I think it's a false choice to say that it's either things happen organically or there are mandates. There are legal mandates. So you have to have X number of types of people on a board of directors. You have to have X number of people filling jobs that are, et cetera. The libertarian movement has a woman problem. Wouldn't we all agree that we, generally speaking, libertarian ideology does not particularly, it is underrepresented among women, among various other groups or subgroups that you might want to call up. What do we do to address that?
I don't know if I agree with the premise, to be honest with you. I mean, Catherine agreed with it in the piece. But Catherine's with the fourth reason editor. Who's,
yeah, I'm not talking about reason. I'm not talking about reason.
I'm asking,
if we're going to be
so
a broad based ideological, pre-political or partisan appeal to people, what do we do? Because we're not appealing to that many, you know, white men at this point. How do we expand outward to find people who are interested in our ideas, who are not the same static group of people that we have? Isn't that, I mean, that's a fair question. And that's I think is a better way to talk about, you know, needs for actual diversity.
Catherine, you look like you have some thoughts. I can see Catherine's thoughts playing across the Kindle of your face.
Yeah. It's cool. I'm a Kindle Paperwhite. I think it's undeniable to say that there are fewer female libertarians than I would like to see, certainly fewer than parity. But I think this very conversation, for instance, has a problem, which is that we are saying, okay, we want to reach out to women, when actually we have a much worse racial diversity problem. We have a much worse, class diversity problem, even than we have a women problem. And I think, you know, ultimately, I guess I think this is what I was trying to get across in this piece is like doing the math over and over and coming up short every time. It should be galvanizing at the individual level, but I have simply not seen any way of doing anything that looks even remotely
but no,
like
no,
a quota,
no, stop quotas, stop quotas. We're not talking about quotas. How do you appeal to different audiences or newer audiences to grow your audience? Hollywood is going through a phase
right.
now,
so
as
I
Peter was talking about, of that it can't just be teenage boys. That used to be the business model was you would appeal to teenage boys who would go and see the same movie over and over again. That's ended for a variety of reasons, partly because the film industry is more global now, and there are different types of things. And this leads to potentially bad problems where things, but...
So I think that one answer here is actually... to think about your inputs rather than your outputs, which is what the Academy has actually done for the Oscars. So the last couple of years, they've admitted record large classes of people into the Academy. Normally, they admit something like 100 or 200 a year. The last couple of years, they've admitted 700 or 900 with the idea of changing the people who vote, right? Like, it's changing the people who make the decisions. So I think in this sense... it's, you know, it's having women in positions to look at the type of content that they're interested in or to produce for, say, a libertarian magazine or to be on a panel or to be on a judging board. I think that that's the, like, to say, act according to your own natural impulses with a more diverse group of people doing those inputs is actually a much better way forward than to mandate the outputs. So that's, and whether, when I say mandate in this case, I mean, you know, whether legally or privately. So like you don't say if it's not 50-50 of, you know, key grips and best boys, we've failed. Like that's obviously wrong. That's obviously wrong. Like more men want to be key grips. I guarantee you, like, the pool of potential key grips is like astronomically more male, and that's fine. But there are some things where women want to be in and can't get in, and making more women gatekeepers, voters, finalist choosers is probably a better way forward.
Catherine, I just want to point out that it did not escape my notice that you subtweeted me in the New York Times. To count something is to see it, to understand it, to have the illusion of control over it. I see you. I see you, Catherine.
I mean, I'm talking to a lot of people like you, Matt, not just you. Although I did walk up to some Welshian mixed metaphors. There's one place where they made me put together both a line about cracked glass ceilings and a line about forest for the trees, like right next to each other, that like hurt my heart a little bit and in a Welshian way.
What if the forest is surrounded by a dome of cracked glass?
I also watched Ready Player One on the plane. So speaking of things surrounded by domes, I want to say just one more thing about that piece, which is that I got the greatest letter to the editor I have ever received about that piece. And it was from a man who wrote to me about the forest for the trees metaphor to tell me that actually, but no, but it was actually good. It was legit good. He to tell me that...
You just actually'd your actually.
The way that you classify forests actually is by counting trees, technically. And what's more, the person who pioneered this particular aspect of forest management was a woman, Dr. Lucy, who got her start because she was less likely to get in trouble skulking around forests during the period she was working, because those same forests were also where people were illegally distilling booze during Prohibition, and strange men walking around the forests were much more likely to get shot. So a lady forestry savant actually did see the forest by counting the trees. Thank you and good night.
I cannot believe how awesome that letter is.
So
it's going to take
great.
A while. I need to sentence diagram that. Let's stay on the topic, more or less, of 50-50 and counting women and mandatory, since we had a ruling written about a little bit on our site this morning by Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Late Friday, U.S. District Judge Gray Miller ruled that it is unlawfully discriminatory to have the selective service, the registration for the draft, which three out of the four of us were subject to on this podcast, although one of us didn't do it, that it's discriminatory in a world where women actually now serve in combat. This doesn't have a binding sense to it. It comes at a time when there's an 11-member commission who's studying the future of the Selective Service. It's supposed to come up with its findings maybe next year or whatever.
And you know who just testified in front of that commission?
Lucy Steigerwald.
Lucy Steigerwald.
Explain why. Woman. That, there we go.
Former Reason contributor Lucy Steigerwald and contributing editor to antiwar.com. She was approached by the commission to come and speak to them.
Yes, which you can see at least pictures of and hopefully also some C-SPAN video of. But on the narrow ruling of it, I'm kind of interested. Nick, we'll start with you. Isn't the ruling kind
sure.
of right?
Like, absolutely.
Shouldn't we not discriminate against, I guess, men? This is brought in by a men's rights groups just to make sure everyone's happy. it's on the legal standing. It's correct.
So,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, the larger point is that totally there should
correct.
Not be selective service registration or, you know, it should be an ad hoc organization that gets put together if and when we need to mobilize large numbers of draftees.
Peter.
And the terrible actual fallout from this, right, is going to be that we wind up with a mealy mouth, squishy half measure where everyone registers, but then some people do national service.
No, I think the
military
think,
service, and in fact, like we all wind up enslaved to the all-powerful state.
I'm
like,
confident that national service is where any of this stuff goes to die. I mean, that's been haunting, you know, America since they ended the draft. People like Bill Bradley back in the 80s and William F. Buckley all, you know, called for national service, and it's always put forth by old white men, in my experience, and it is always rejected by anybody with a pulse, regardless of race, class, gender, or sexual orientation. So I hope that they try to push this as a good thing, you know, the people who are more status, whether they're right wing or left wing, because now you'll have fully 100% of people saying, fuck you.
I do want to say, like, this is the flip side of all of the, like, you know, when people talk about how women are, you know, perform a disproportionate amount of caregiving or emotional labor or carry the mental load and all this kind of stuff, like the flip side of that is two things. One, sometimes men have to go die by being shot in the fucking face with a gun, rather more often than women do. And two, broadly, men carry concern about the financial situation of their households more than women do. So, like, I think it will be interesting to see if we equalize the cost that men bear of potentially dying in war, how that shakes out other aspects of gender inequality. Like, I can see the feminist case for women in the selective service, full stop, and women drafted when the time comes. I think it is wildly unlikely that that is how it will actually play out, because that's not the current political dynamic that we work in. But I disagree with Nick. I think that it is very likely that the place where this ends up is a horrible, squishy, exception-riddled national service.
A quick response to that, which is that as much as millennials may be in favor of guaranteed jobs by the government, guaranteed government jobs, I think putting this out there and saying you will, even the specter of you will register and you will report to some kind of place at this given time, at this given moment, otherwise you're going to jail, that unmasks, you know, really what undergirds a lot of this stuff. And I think there'll be a lot of pushback.
I wonder, Peter, first of all, you turned 18, like right when the Twin Towers came down, right? Or like close enough to it.
I turned 18 in 1999.
Okay.
So just a couple of years before.
But like, I turned 18 in 1986, and I presume that there's kind of a category difference, even in that short window of difference between us, of thinking that this might come into play, right? Like when you registered, were you in the back of your mind worried that you might get drafted to go to Kosovo or something?
I had grown up in the idea that that was going to be how the military was populated just didn't really cross my mind at the time. I'd grown up in a military community where everybody was there by choice. It seemed relatively functional, and it didn't seem like anybody was was sort of really thinking, okay, we've got to bring in people who simply don't want to be here. In fact, most people in the, at least where I grew up, and it was a somewhat unusual military community in that it's the kind of the East Coast testing facility for the Air Force. So, it's like their kind of R&D shop. There was a widespread notion, I think, that on the one hand, the kids these days, they're very lazy and like somebody needs to kick their butt. On the other hand, having wars fought by people who simply don't want to be part of the military is probably a bad idea for war fighting.
I should just point out, because it's a bit of esoteric knowledge that I have and it'll be transitory, that Pete McCloskey, someone no one's ever heard of, but he was a liberal California Republican for a long time, and he tried to run a primary against Richard Nixon in 1972. I did a reasoned search on him to see if he came up in anything except obscure Dave Weigel references. And he did, like in the late 70s or early 80s, Bob Poole wagged a finger at him because this guy who ran against Nixon as an anti-war guy, saying Nixon lied about getting us out of Vietnam. He went around Congress and this guy. So he was the anti-war Republican person who got squashed like a bug in New Hampshire. He, of course, by 1980 or so, was a huge champion of mandatory national service, which loses the point. Catherine, you are already imagining the nightmare scenario of where this goes. I mean, ending the military draft is like a top five libertarian victory. This is Milton Friedman going in there and talking Richard Nixon and the rest of them. This is the access. You know, it's like people who are criticizing, you know, Kim Kardashian and Kanye West from going to the White House. Well, you know what? They got the first step back. That was Milton Friedman, all of his access to right wing. We ended the draft here. And yet this little ghost of a thing, which doesn't, in fairness, affect a lot of people. I think they've prosecuted about six people for not registering to the draft over the years, and usually had to, like, you know, do something very public and flagrant around it. And I don't think they've done anything in the last 15 or so years on this. But these little ghosts, it's like we never can have a pure libertarian victory. You know, we got rid of alcohol prohibition and we got all this sort of regime hangover here. We did airline deregulation first, and now we're kind of last in the civilized world about, you know, having private nonprofit air control and ownership of airlines and ownership and this kind of stuff. Do we ever get a clean win, Catherine?
Nope. Sorry. It's not how it is.
I thought you're supposed to come back from vacation all happy and like.
I said it cheerfully. I mean, I think, you know, this is the thing, right? It's like, you know, we've been running the same stories in Reason for 50 years. We're going to run them for another 50 years. Even nearly complete victories can be reversed. And this is like a good cautionary tale. I think, you know, the burning of a selective service card. Is there even a card? I'm not sure because of my female privilege. But the burning of your selective service card obviously lacks the same punch as the burning of your draft card. But, you know, there's also this weird element of technology in this question, which is like, if we need to rapidly call up Americans between the ages of 18 and 24, like, it used to be a little harder to keep track of everyone, so we had to have like a giant freaking file cabinet with all their names alphabetized.
But now we've got Facebook.
But also, you know, the amount of data collection that the federal government does on its citizens is now so incredibly intense that the Selective Service is totally symbolic. Like, if and when they want to get all the 18-year-olds and slap tin cans on their heads and point them in the direction of North Korea, selective service or not selective service.
Yeah, what is the scam operation like, you know, getting scofflaws to show up by offering them Super Bowl tickets? What would work best for millennials to say, hey, you know, just, yeah, you know, there's a free avocado toast.
Free avocado toast.
Wait, well, no. It's we'll pay your college loans.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders has already got the hook in that one.
Yeah. I will just add that I think Catherine is, if I have to pick between the Catherine and Nick sides of this service
always
debate,
do.
I will definitely side with Catherine just
she could poke your eyes out.
Self-preservation.
Just because she's my boss.
Yeah.
But also because,
fear for
you
your
know,
physical
I was
safety.
I was at one of these sort of events with like kind of a small group of conservative types talking about the future of, you know, the whatever.
And it's like, literally every event that you ever
have. I go to these things and like the dinner ended and the person who was hosting the dinner said, you know, kind of finished off with the comment that, well, you know, like a lot of us always say, wouldn't it be great if we could have a war without the war? And national service is that. And that's and
yeah,
like
who is,
we
who's
say
weak?
That?
No, no,
who
I don't say that. But
the conservatives,
a, but there are
the
people, on, but there are people
that.
Who
true.
Are more conservative.
Yeah,
they
and,
want a galvanizing national project.
People in the Weekly Standard mold in some ways, right? The sort of the neoconservative.
They broke that mold.
Yep. Right. But in the kind of neoconservative American greatness, right? And I mean, there's you can imagine even some appetite for this amongst kind of the Trump intellectual class to the extent that it exists, right? But like the perhaps, I mean, I could certainly imagine the Journal of American Greatness publishing a case for this, also perhaps against as well. But there is like, I mean, a big part of the kind of conservative critique of American culture right now is that it has lost a collective purpose. And you see that with a lot of the reporting on opioids and on kind of the struggling white working class and national service. People believe I to be clear, I am wildly opposed to this, but national service, a lot of people believe would provide that purpose.
When in fact, what it would provide is like a year of screwing around to check a box.
Well, you know, AOC also, I mean, is talking about the need for a Green New Deal and for a transformation of American society on every level. As you know, this is her generation's World War II. So that Marshall metaphor, which implies a real stratification and rigidification of American society, where the government dictates lots and lots more stuff, also believes in that. And what I'm saying is when it gets to that point, and it is something that it inhabits parts of the left and parts of the right for sure, people will be like, get the fuck out of here. There is nothing that is going to piss people off more than the idea that you have to be in a particular place at a particular time for a year or two when you're 18 or 19 or whatever. There might be the sweeteners of saying, come and shovel shit for a while, and will reduce or eliminate your student loans. But don't worry about national service. It has no future.
One of the worst arguments that you'll see in favor of it, and it's a left-wing argument usually, is that either that this will like provide mass resistance against whatever military thing abroad, and it doesn't really work that way, or it knits together society in a way. You know, it's just like jury duty. You know, you see people from all walks of life, and that it really helps. And Europe, which is thankfully for its own sake, gotten out of the mandatory draft game for the most part, all throughout the continent. And that's just over in the last 25 years they did. But in France, which I have some knowledge of, you know, my brother-in-law, or the older one, signed up for it. We would see when living in Central Europe, the class stratification of what you got to do for your national service was amazing. If you came from kind of Nowheresville, you were grunting in the mud and getting beaten up if you were kind of a sissy or whatever. It was an awful, awful experience. If you were a fancy lad going to a nice school or from a nice family, you'd get to go to Budapest, for example. You would get paid, you would have your national service would be working for Nestle, not Nestle, but a French Danone, you know, a French multinational, getting paid at Western rates in an Eastern country. So you live like an absolute king. They put on the best parties, just champagne everywhere, these rich French people. And it was disgusting. I mean, I
feel like you weren't going to say people there for a second.
I am trying to keep it clean here. But yeah, it's hard not to succumb to alliteration there. There's just no way that, and this is the lived in experience of also the Vietnam era draft, you know the difference of the people who avoided the war and the people who couldn't avoid the war. And it was very class-based. So I look forward to any idiots making those arguments because they're totally wrong. Nick, you were the part of the first generation, right? When this came up, what did you remember? What was the active, or was there? Because maybe I'm just a paranoid person, and we'd all watched Red Dawn.
Hey, you know what? But, Red Dawn showed that when push comes to shove, you don't need a draft because the Wolverines inside
of
us.
That was my argument.
Yeah.
What you need well, is Patrick
and we're missing
Swayze.
Patrick Swayze. We need, he needs to be de-extincted before the Mastodon.
If the Ruskies were going to come in, I was going to go full Wolverines. There was never a question about that. I just didn't want to go to Nicaragua.
What about Venezuela, Matt? Would you go to Venezuela?
I was going
to
do that, you damn person.
Beat you.
You beat me. But like, what do Nick, do you remember an animating concern back when that happened? Were you filled with terror at being drafted into the Cold War? Or was it you were just in New Jersey
smoking all the pot. And I had a father who was a World War II vet who told me that he would either break my legs or get me to Canada so that I would never have to serve. So I felt pretty comfortable there. I actually, this was part of my political awakening because I ended up corresponding with a conscientious objector group that's based in Philadelphia, and they counseled to fill out the registration card, but also send along a note explaining that you would refuse to be inducted to fight in any war under any circumstance. So that's what I basically did, and I am sure that that's when my shockingly thin but hopefully present FBI file was started on me. And I also complained that at least for the renewal of the registration, you had to put your own stamp on it to update your thing. Yeah.
They're literally coming for you right now. You can hear them in the background.
They sent... I didn't register, and I don't think I responded. I don't remember, but they sent a lot of very threatening letters to me. And at one point when I was 18 or 19 and my life had gone to hell in an unrelated set of bad decisions, my parents were reunited, which is something that rarely happened back in those days or these. And they decided that, well, the first thing you need to do is register for that damn draft, which I didn't do. It wasn't the first thing I needed to do.
So did you ever, like, where does that stand?
That's it. I mean, they don't prosecute you. The thing is, you're barred from getting student loans and things like that, which was never really an impact because I didn't last very long in college, but also I went in the UC system, which wasn't that expensive back then. But if I wanted to go back and, you know, finish off my undergraduate degree, I would need to pay for it by my own loan. And I think there's probably a couple of other things that I'm barred from doing because of that. But no one really cares enough to prosecute that. I did meet a dude at the Massachusetts Libertarian Party convention, whose name I'm blanking on, but who was, I think, one of those six people who
there
like,
were
fought
a
this
number
forever,
of fairly high profile cases of, early on. The other thing that was fascinating about that, too, is that Reagan, Jimmy Carter started that, and Reagan campaigned saying that he would get rid of it because he had a whole rap about how the draft and the military conscription was actually undermined American democracy. And he had a kind of apocryphal quote from Lenin. Talking about, you know, conscription is one way to destroy societies, et cetera. And then the minute he got in, he was like, you know what? It sounds like a pretty good idea. So I'm going to keep doing it.
Let's transition to Venezuela, as Catherine rightly pointed out that we are going to do or foreshadowed. All kinds of alarming news coming out of not just about Venezuela, but about the U.S. Kind of involvement with it. There's even today... Associated Press headline, Pence in Bogota to discuss ways to oust Venezuela's Maduro, which isn't very cheerful, even if, like everybody on this podcast, you'd think Maduro would be great to oust himself. Axios reported, and I got this out of a Nick Gillespie blog post, that Trump's senior advisors are, quote, universally support unseating Maduro. Nick, you wrote about this. Marco Rubio had a particularly atrocious tweet. Maybe you can walk us through that. What's going on and what are you worried about?
Well, what little Marco did over the weekend, he put up two diptychs. One was a picture of Manuel Noriega, the former leader of Panama, wielding a machete. And then the other was his booking photo when he was deposed and then arrested and put in an American jail for the rest of his life. He died a few years ago. And then the other one, which was more unsettling in many ways, was a before and after picture of Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. And it was those both went without words and the clear implication based on things that Rubio has said, as well as other tweets. What happened to Libya, which is that he was deposed, and they're coming for me even more now, He was taken from office, or he was booted from office in part because of a NATO strike that the U.S. participated in. And then he was later, killed in the streets. He was sodomized by a bayonet or a knife, depending on the accounts, before he was finally shot to death at the hands of people who were obviously right to hate Gaddafi's guts, etc. But it's, you know, the idea that a Republican senator would be doing this, or also people in the American government would be looking at the Libya intervention as some sign of success of American foreign policy, is deeply disturbing, because not only was it unconstitutional in multiple ways, but it also has produced a failed state that is worse off now and destabilizes that region and the world more than it did under Gaddafi, who had also, after getting his ass kicked in various ways by the United States, had actually started to help the American intelligence apparatus after 9/11. The fear here is that the United States is going to intervene militarily in Venezuela at the point when they seem to be doing a pretty good job of overthrowing a shitty government by themselves and with the support of virtually every other government in Latin America and Canada. And with growing worldwide pressure for Maduro to step down, the U.S., which has a terrible record of intervening in Latin America, can throw its weight in and then kind of make it actually more likely that people will think of this as an American-led coup or as something sullied by American presence.
Catherine, is this hawk whack-a-mole? I mean, we've got Elliot Abrams. We've got the carcass of Elliot Abrams, Iran-Contra criminal. John Bolton's in there. Little Marco is who's always been a very strong and interested interventionist all over the globe, Syria and et cetera. They never go away, do they, Catherine?
They sure don't. I was actually just looking back at Bolton's endorsement or seeming endorsement of the Libya model as a template for how we would deal with North Korea, which you may recall the last time around ended up sort of stalling talks with North Korea because the powers that be rightly feared that an administration casually referencing how things went down with Gaddafi might not be super interested in protecting their safety during a transition. Rubio seems to have doubled down on that with his really just totally shocking tweet. I am forced to confront the possible alternate reality where Rubio is president and things are actually like worse. I think there was this notion among the kind of Republican, normies that Rubio would be okay, that Rubio was sort of a mainstream dude. And this is, these tweets are not the act of a sort of chill mainstream dude. But as you rightly point out, Matt, like the hawks are always with us. They are always just waiting for the right opportunity to reignite a war, to unite America's soul or whatever. Alternate theory about the Gaddafi tweet, though. It was just Rubio predicting the Oscar win because, of course, Gaddafi's manifesto. Yeah,
that's very good.
The Green Book.
That's very good.
Wow.
So you're saying that he should have gotten a screenwriting credit for
the
win?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. That's correct.
I would point out to
how did he know? I mean, PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Rubio knows. Okay. Rubio's got the connects.
It's like how Obama got to see Game of Thrones early.
Yes, exactly like that.
I've probably referenced it before, but it's always worth looking at the Republican presidential debate from February 2016 when there had just been some North Korea news and the moderator asked the assembled, so should we have preemptive strikes on the launch pad in North Korea? And basically everyone, with the exception of Donald Trump and maybe one other, fell over themselves saying things like, yep, Jeb Bush, like, yep, sometimes you got to just show people that you mean business. And John Kasich and Rubio and everybody else. It's amazing how much default hawkishness is with us.
Yeah, so it's interesting to go back and look at that, especially the Republican debates. And there was actually a kind of fascinating Tucker Carlson essay in the American Conservative, of all places, which is a real thing that is happening in this world, in which Carlson pointed to the moment that Trump differentiated himself on the Iraq war and said this was a bad idea. This was done badly by the entire Republican establishment, and basically just sort of took a very harsh and critical line in a way that, like, even Republicans who were trying to kind of say, well, maybe we made some mistakes and we could have prosecuted the war a little better, really was just like, no, this was a terrible and stupid idea.
And he did it, it did it in South Carolina, to be sure.
Yep, in South Carolina, which is possibly certainly one of the most kind of Republican hawkish states in the country, sort of a bastion of GOP hawkism. I don't know if I think Carlson is completely correct that that was the single moment, but if you're going to pick just one, it's not a bad point. At the same time, to bring it back to Venezuela, Trump has long apparently kind of wanted to invade and basically sees Venezuela as a place that we could extract a bunch of oil from. I mean, there's a quote in the McCabe book, Andrew McCabe, the former acting FBI director, in which McCabe says that Trump, back as far as summer of 2017, was saying, "Well, I think we should invade because they have all that oil."
It is,
and it really kind of casts It undermines to some extent the idea that Trump is a kind of...
Yeah, there's also a story going around that he basically, through Marco Rubio, met a bunch of Venezuelans, and also there are a number of Venezuelan expats in southern Florida that he interacts with, that for him it's personal and that he wants to help these people by invading Venezuela and taking it over.
He gave a big speech in 2017 down there. I think it was mm-hmm. even in Little Havana, where he talked about both Venezuela and Cuba in pretty
And he more recently also talked about that. I mean, in a speech where and this is one of the kind of themes of the 2020 election, which is shaping up, is Trump started this in the State of the Union, but then more recently in Miami, I guess it was, talked about how America will never be a socialist country, and he using Venezuela as the counterweight to that. And it'll be interesting, that's the wrong word for it, but whether or not he will feel a need to literally defeat socialism by bringing military, American military power to bear or not. It seems to me, both from a rhetorical, but more importantly, from a humanitarian and a pragmatic level, you know, this is a government which is going to tip over. And the thing, and this is probably the hardest thing for a superpower to do, is to step out and not make it about yourself. There's such a strong force against the Maduro regime. It's clearly in its last days. You don't want to do something that might actually galvanize people, in the same way that, you know, one of the tragedies that nobody ever talks about of the Iraq invasion is that kicked the legs out from a nascent Iranian revolt against its regime, because once America is parked in the country next door to you that has long been your regional rival, you know, people become much more nationalistic. And to me, one of the things that hasn't even gotten started yet, but is where do the Democrats for 2020 stand on foreign policy? Because a lot of them, you know, will be like, oh, well, you know, I hate Trump. I think he sucked. And Bush was obviously a disaster. But the fact is that there's an enormous amount of continuity, both in terms of objectives and strategies, and then also failure between Bush, Obama, and Trump, but we're not really having that conversation.
I will just top it off by pointing out that Bernie Sanders has been put in a strange position, a Malachi Crunch position here about Venezuela, where Florida Democrats are absolutely roasting him for refusing to call Maduro a dictator. Didn't use the D word. But meanwhile, also he's getting ratioed on Twitter by Roger Waters and other people, because he tweeted out that the people of Venezuela are enduring a serious humanitarian crisis. The Maduro government must put the needs of its people first, allow humanitarian aid into the country, and refrain from violence against protesters, which was seen as basically a neoconservative take by a lot of people on the left who are allergic to U.S. interventionism abroad. That's going to be a weird position for Bernie to be in, especially since he, and I see a lot more of the video clips which I think Michael Moynihan, our friend, former colleague, was first kind of popularized 4 years ago. But there's just a ton of video out there of Bernie Sanders way later than one ever ought to, like 1988, saying super nice things about his recent trip to the Soviet Union and how everything is, you know, they've made a lot of accomplishments there. And he's had similar comments about Cuba. And I would presume, without knowing, and I will correct if this is not the case, that he probably said semi-friendly things at some point about Hugo Chavez, or at least about some of the work that was being done there. But we'll put a button on that and go to our libertarian movie hour here. We won't tease it by saying it's the most libertarian or the best libertarians, but just some libertarian movies throughout history here of interest and of note. And Peter, since you're going to talk the longest, we'll go to you first.
Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters is a great, like, libertarian. I mean, it's a movie about a bunch of guys who get out of the academic sector because you can't really do anything, launch a small business to solve a real problem, and then get shut down by the EPA and end up having to argue, effectively the EPA or the city health authority or whatever, and then end up having to go to the mayor's office, like, to argue for their, for that, like, they have a reason to exist because they will save the city. It's a great movie about, like, about entrepreneurship and about how regulation is just a power grab that actually hurts people.
What about the Lady reboot? Still libertarian?
Less so.
I will go next because
the regulation angle got played down a little bit.
It's the same. It's the same story, only a little bit less funny. The Dallas Buyers Club.
Oh, you stole my choice, Matt Welch. You scumbag!
I knew. Yeah. That's why I had to go second. I had to pull the rug out from under.
You guys shouldn't fight over it. Can you guys join monologue?
We already are. We already.
Do you have to say
are.
Alternate?
Go ahead, Matt.
Like one of those Oscar speeches where everybody's trying to read the thing together.
It's basically Peter's story. It's about the true story of or true-ish of Ron Woodruff, an AIDS patient.
Ghostbusters is not a true story.
I'm not sure about that. Who was diagnosed in the 80s and found that people couldn't get the right drugs, the right cocktails of drugs, and the FDA would not approve anything. The FDA is even a bigger villain than the EPA is in Ghostbusters here. And he starts smuggling unapproved treatments to help people in the Dallas areas, and it's great. Matthew McConaughey is phenomenal in it, as is Jared Leto. I think they both won Oscars in it, and it's directed. And one of the reasons why I like it as a libertarian movie is that the director is a French guy, Jean-Marc Vallée, and I'm just guessing, purely because he's French, that he didn't wake up in the morning saying, I'm going to make a libertarian movie. He just made a movie about a thing that happened and a story. And that helps, I think, make it even become a more potent. Nick, if you want to add anything to my embellishments.
No, I think it's a fantastic movie. And yeah, as you were saying, I mean, you know, what's great, and this is also true of Ghostbusters, is that they're libertarian, you know, kind of directionally or temperamentally, but they're, I mean, you know, they're not dogmatic films in any way, shape, or form, which makes them even better.
And they're good, right?
They're filled with,
I mean, they're not just sort of like, well, this is kind of interesting because it speaks to whatever ideological priors. It's that if you don't share those ideological priors, or you don't have any at all, like a lot of people, you won't necessarily notice that there is a kind of ideological, a directionality to the movie underpinning, you know, sort of a thematic underpinning that supports that stuff. And you will notice that these movies are really delightfully made and entertaining, that they fulfill the first job of a movie, which is to make you enjoy it for a couple of hours.
My entry fits right into this mold, which is Home Alone, a true libertarian film in which Macaulay Culkin is basically the Blackwater of his own home.
Oh, God.
And also free-range parenting at its best. The end.
Yeah, I think the only thing bad is that he accepts the parents back at the end. Because didn't he have squatter's rights on the house?
He should have at that point asserted them. Yeah, that's correct.
Well, I'll follow up with a movie that is somewhat similar and is The Incredibles, the original Incredibles. The Incredibles 2 is also good, but you know, that movie was read by many, although the director Brad Bird ended up saying absolutely not, but as a kind of Ayn Rand, animated tale of people who were being forced to hide their superiority because it was unfair, or the government was against it. In the context of the movie, the superheroes have been actually made illegal and forced to go undercover because they were too spectacular and too good at what they did. But my reading of that, and this is true of a lot of Pixar movies as well, is that the real hero of the piece is Syndrome, who is the normal non-mutant, non-superpowered guy who ends up creating all sorts of inventions and gadgets in order to make himself superpowered and also to sell to rogue nations in various ways. And in a weird way, I think a lot of times movies, whatever the main story they're telling, there's a secret occult reading. And I think that when we look at somebody like Syndrome and we see, something about individual ambition and self-fulfillment and trying to create what you are not and become a full version of however you define yourself is actually the best libertarian element of it.
So you're saying that Benicio del Toro was the secret hero of The Last Jedi?
Yeah, pretty much. Buddy in Toy Story is clearly the hero, the next door neighbor who takes the toys and turns them into whatever he wants.
Have you been obviously reading the hero. A lot of Sonny Bunch recently?
Peter, I was writing these readings for a reason for Toy Story in like whenever it came out, 1995 or something.
Before Sonny Bunch was born.
Before Sonny Bunch was born, I was writing college film school treatises on how the only moral character in Rear Window was Raymond Burr. So take that, Sonny Bunch. That's all the Sonny Bunch takes we could possibly.
Sonny Bunch does sound like a made-up.
Yeah, it's not a real.
Hey, you guys, I have just one question because I missed some of the news while I was away. Is soda illegal in California now? Did that happen while I was gone?
Not yet.
Like, there's some kind of additional.
You can't is it that you're not allowed to sell it over a certain amount of
It's
actually just that LaCroix is mandatory.
Oh, that's fine. You know what? I drank Fanta all week and I have no regrets. So
it's certainly better than drinking Fanta LaCroix, forever. Which is garbage and I don't even know how to pronounce it. Okay. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for listening. Please write little reviews and give us all the stars at your podcast dispensaries, legal or illegal. And see you next week. Bye.